Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. Very excited today because we have Debbie Wasko with us. Nice to see you, Debbie.
Hi. I was so excited. Yeah.
Not really, because Debbie's a real, somewhat of a mover and shaker. I would say she's one of the leading entrepreneurs in the UK, at least out there prominent, forging a path for not just herself, but she's on a real mission to help other, particularly women and female founders in their career, which is how I know of her, because my wife has a small business and she was a big fan of Debbie's outfit, Allbright, which she co-founded in 2018 to help women network and grow their careers. But she's a real serial investor over a number of years since 2000, including a series of exits, including one with Love Home Swap, which she sold for $53 million back in 2017, which is a lot of money. And she was awarded an OBE in June 2016 and the Freedom of the City of London, I believe.
That's the most important thing. I get to drive my goats across the London Bridge.
Well, I hope you have done that already. I was hoping that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I wondered if that got you. You didn't have that meant you didn't have to queue to get into the Ministry of Sound now.
That too. Yeah.
She's an investor, a thought leader, an author. A great book called Believe, Build, Become: How to Supercharge Your Career, which you should check out. It's a fantastic, very hands-on manual for progressing your career. But so I'm super excited because there's a litany of illustrious achievements which we can list off there. And obviously, we're going to dig into all of those and find out what really happened behind the scenes. That's what it's all about today. But before we kick off, I just remind you that this podcast is brought to you by my company, The Tech Department. That's the one that I blew up in 2017 and is the reason why we created this podcast, because we did turn it around and it's doing really well. But if you do like what we're doing here to sort of help share war stories from entrepreneurship, please share it amongst your peers and colleagues and rate us on Apple Podcasts and all that good stuff, because that really helps us get our message out. So do a good thing and help us help other entrepreneurs just like you. So let's get into it. And I'm really excited because you started your entrepreneurial career in 2000, which is just the year before when I set up my first business. You were 25 years old, I believe, and you set up a company called Mantra, a PR agency. And I read somewhere that this is great because this is where you learnt your quotes hard lessons. And I'm really interested to find out, what was your hardest of your hard lessons from back in your first company?
Your first business, and my experience of that, to take a tiny step back, is that I'm from a family of entrepreneurs, but they would never use that word to describe themselves. That's a bit of a fancy word, but they would call themselves business owners. And I grew up in Sheffield, where I know you're from, in a Jewish immigrant community where I didn't know anybody who went to work for someone else. Everybody worked for themselves, and many of those businesses were pretty humble businesses. My grandparents sold fruit and veg in Sheffield Market. My maternal grandmother, who was a huge role model, who died age 97, having outlived three husbands and never having learned how to reverse a car, aspire to in that, ended up running a chain of sweet shops and off licenses from Sheffield and across Yorkshire. So I think a big part of doing what I did and the lessons that I started to learn from 25 onwards were a combination of, I suppose, being in the genes, if you believe in that. But I think very importantly for women, and part of the DNA of my career, is that you have to see it to be it. And I grew up amongst women who were matriarchs, and I'm one of five children, but who worked for themselves. And so that completely normalized entrepreneurial risk, because I didn't know any sensible people who went to work for somebody else every day and came home, and it wasn't really like that in our house. And business was discussed around the kitchen table from a very, very young age. And I'm very mindful of that with my own children, that it just gives you an exposure and it normalizes risk and it normalizes the highs and the lows of self-determination. So when I set up my first business, I'd had the other thing that's very important in those kinds of Jewish immigrant communities is academic excellence, which is totally non-negotiable in our house. So I'm a nerd and remain a nerd. So having graduated from Oxford, I did a very conventional management consultancy start to my career. And I suppose that was the first life lesson, that I was not a very good management consultant. In fact, I was easily the worst of my intake. And I've never been bad at anything in my life prior to that, because I'm an academic overachiever. And I think there was a real lesson to being crap at your first job about focusing on the things that you're good at and the sort of recognition of the things that you're good at. And a lot of the skills that have been very important as I've developed as an entrepreneur, communication and storytelling and fundraising and getting to the nub of a commercial problem, and they're not skills that are really valued when you're a junior employee, but they are skills that are absolutely critical when you launch business number one. So Mantra was a communications and marketing agency founded in .com1, as it's now known, under the sort of proviso that in a gold rush, you make money from picks and shovels. And it was a journey of 7 years to exit. And it was a big exit for an agency. And I learned everything I know in that business, because when I started, I didn't know anything, right? And an agency business where you're effectively trying to sell time for money and productize that is an extremely good first business to learn about cash flow. I check the company bank balance every day, and I still do that, age 48 and a half and business number four, about how to manage people, about how to motivate them, about what to do when there's a massive downturn, which there was 13 months after we launched the business, with the sort of dot-com crash of 2000-2001, and how to ride that out, and a lot of words that are now very modern and current around pivoting, and nobody sort of really talked about that then, but it was just what you did if the business was about to go tits. So I just sort of learned everything in that business, the good, the bad, and the ugly, how to build towards an exit, how to build margin. A lot of the rules that I still really hold true around, and to sort of bring us up to present day and then back again, Anna Jones, who's my co-founder in Albright and one of the world's great women and people, and I always discuss our life, work-life triangle, and that says have fun, make money, and don't work with, I'll put it politely, don't work with assholes. And I really developed that during that time, because in that first business, you don't know what you don't know. It's very easy to get yourself into situations with people where the fit isn't there, with investors where the fit isn't there. And frankly, a lot of those lessons are a lifelong journey, right? Because you're always, as an entrepreneur, particularly one who raises capital for their business, and that's what I do. Not all entrepreneurs do that, but that's the nature of the businesses that I've built. You're selling the dream, and once the dream has been sold, then you actually have to execute on the plan, and you generally don't have the people, resources, or in some cases, the sort of ideas. And so you're always doing everything in a hurry, and that's my personality anyway. I'm known as the whirlwind, you know, I'm kind of in and I'm out, and I think that those early lessons in Mantra remain my daily lessons, which is I make all of my worst mistakes in a rush, and my personality is to rush. And I think that Mantra was that writ large around investors and hiring. And I think that the sort of final point on that is that things always look really rosy from the outside. And one of my other sort of catchphrases is that everybody has their shit. No matter how amazing it all looks, and Mantra looks amazing, right? I was a kid, I sold the business and made lots of money, but there were so many horror shows along the way. And the trick to it is to try and remain true to the commercial realities of the business and its basic economics, and just to keep it moving along. And Mantra was a lesson in that.
Interesting. I'm just going to dwell around that, because I'm always curious with entrepreneurs at the start of their journey before it, because looking back, obviously things progress and they go well and you get your freedom of the City of London and all that.
Yeah.
But at the time, 13 months in, it starts going a bit squiffy because the dot-com starts going squiffy. Because I'm kind of interested in that moment when you're stood on the edge of the precipice, right? You know, before it turns around and you've worked it out, before you figured it out. Can you remember what it felt like? Could you just launched a business? I imagine it's started and you're excited and the adrenaline's pumping and you're out doing your whirlwind thing.
Yeah.
And 13 months in, it starts going off-piste because of the economy.
Yeah.
So what was happening in your emotional state just at that moment?
Well, it's the great thing about being young that your emotional state's not very well developed, or mine wasn't, in the way that now I have a life full of responsibilities, both practical responsibilities, children, life, husband, aging parents, everything that we all have. And also a little bit, I suppose, my reputation because of all the way that you teed me up, and that's been built up over time. And actually that means that the stakes get higher because I didn't really think about or care about failing when I was 25 or six, because another life mantra is, which gets me into trouble sometimes, what's the worst that can happen? What's the worst that can happen? You know, and when you're 26, what is the worst that can happen? Nothing, you know, nothing bad, right? Doesn't work out, you know. You fail as an entrepreneur, you get a job. I just have always had quite a lot of swagger. And I don't know whether that's a sort of academic or intellectual confidence, or a confidence that just comes from feeling like I've got the strength of personality to deal with a lot of crap. I just have. I've got broad shoulders, both literally, because I go boxing every morning, and figuratively. So I wasn't plagued with self-doubt. I've never been plagued with self-doubt, actually, but in a way it sort of gets a bit greater the older you get, I think, when the stakes are higher. I think at that young age, I felt like I'd figure it out. I felt like I'd figure it out, and I didn't feel the same responsibility to myself as I feel now around making tough calls, right? And life's about tough calls, and some of them are really tough. And those economically tough calls are hard because they involve laying people off and changing the plan, and, you know, and we really have been through that at Albright because of the global pandemic. I think it gets harder the more that people's expectations of you grow. And I think when you're a kid, nobody expects anything, right? People don't expect you to succeed in the way that we succeeded. And I think the other thing in all of this, what's the worst that can happen? But I've always had quite a well-developed, the power of fuck you. So I really feel like you have to harness the dark as well as the light in life. And I'm very driven by the sunlit uplands, right? I love being excited about business, mine, other people's, why I invest so much. You know, I love it. And because my Albright life is I only back women, I love nothing more than female founders pitch day at Albright, was yesterday actually, and seeing six young women pitch their businesses, and I'm excited for all of them, and I want to figure out how I can help, and. Cross me, and the power of fuck you runs, like, you're on my list, right? And I've got a list, and I think most people have a list, and I find that equally as motivating as the power of creation. So understanding yourself and what makes you tick, and balancing the light and shade, I think is a really important way of dealing with the difficult stuff.
That's really interesting. There's a number of themes in there, the kind of shadow side of that, of one's character, and the kind of harnessing that energy and turning it into positive energy rather than perhaps negative energy. I'm interested in that. But actually, this paradox between 25-year-old, I'll wing it, sort it out, Debbie, and then now global pandemic kicks off, Albright with an OBE, Debbie, with a CV that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Because this is an interesting point, actually. This is sort of, there's a bit of a yin-yang there of like, you see, you have your, it's all to lose now. Okay, so can you sort of focus on that point? Because it seems to be, this brings us up to date, perhaps, to this sort of moment. You got .com where it was low stakes, perhaps pandemic stakes are a bit higher. What happened at the start of the pandemic?
I mean, it was by far the worst of times, the worst time in my career by a long way, partly because I think Albright is a business that's about purpose. Anna and I co-founded Albright just over 4 years ago to try and change the conversation for women at work. Because what we had both experienced in different ways is that the needle had not moved in a 20-year plus career. In my case, for female entrepreneurs, we don't raise capital, we don't invest capital, we don't get backed. The stats are getting worse, not better, particularly in the UK. And Anna was the only female CEO of a media business in the UK. She was the CEO of Hearst in her mid to late 30s. And there were no other female CEOs. She was the first female CEO in the history of Hearst, despite the fact that 85% of its media titles reached a female audience. So we bonded, and we were set up completely randomly at a party by a mutual friend who said, you two should be friends. And sometimes your life can change in a moment. And our lives changed when we met each other. An amazing friendship. She's just a brilliant person. She's from York. She's a sort of fellow northern grafter, as she would describe both of us, and I'm fellow traveller and kids the same age and life. But primarily this question of where are all the women? And at our age and stage, with the mutual CVs, and the ages equally, if not more impressive than mine in a different kind of way, in a corporate way, and between the two of us, in the UK, we sort of know everybody worth knowing, and we've got very good powers of persuasion. Like, okay, if we can we move the needle together? What's the business that combines purpose with profit? If you're trying to create, without sounding grand, but a legacy by the time you reach our stage, what do we want our legacy to be? Well, I want my legacy to have changed the world of work for women in the UK and beyond, because I've grown up with working women, and they have been standout examples of going against the grain. And I don't want that to be the case for my daughters and my son. So when the pandemic hit, the Albright business was flying. We'd raised a lot of private equity money, and there's still a macho culture where the amount that you raise determines your success, even though we know that isn't always the case. We've just closed a round, and at the center of the business model was an ecosystem that involved physical spaces. So we run members clubs, women-only members, Enlightened Men Welcome as our guests, and they're a way of bringing into a physical reality networks, upskilling, confidence, resilience, spaces by women, for women, about women, and sort of subverting the traditional gentleman's club, if you like. And that was the heart of the business model. We were launching a digital platform that was going to be a Masterclass meets LinkedIn for women, and. And the pandemic struck, and within the space of 10 days, all our buildings were shut. All of our physical memberships were on pause. We furloughed hundreds of people. We had just opened a building in Los Angeles that we couldn't get to. There was no furlough in the US. We laid everybody off. And it was extremely challenging. And additionally, we had to really fast track the launch of the digital platform that was meant to be launching in June. So it might not be finished, but whatever, we've got to get it out there and be there for our community, because we had 500,000 women across our platforms who didn't know what to do. And they wanted, and Albright very much is Anna and I's face on the, you know, tin. And if you think back to that time, none of us knew how to do that. None of us knew that we were going to be broadcasters in our own home with three children homeschooling and not enough Wi-Fi and a ring light that I'd never used before. And what the hell was an Instagram Live anyway? And how did I, you know, I don't really feel like doing my hair and putting my makeup on and saying, we're here, ask us anything. And we did it. We did it every day. And it was really grim, and I didn't always feel like doing it. And I felt like, I didn't feel like the business was going to go bust, but that was simply a question of timing. Because we had raised our money at a convenient time. But I did feel like the decisions that we were making that were forced upon us because of the pandemic were having an impact, a real impact on people's lives. We were really, really worried about what was going to happen to our team. We found it really hard to live our values, because we employ very different types of people doing different types of things. And they were being asked to behave in different ways, because you had the sort of marketing and digital team who are working every hour God sends from their homes. You had the club team who didn't have jobs and were on furlough. It was really sort of HR complicated. I had been flying to Los Angeles twice a month, which was horrible. Couldn't get there. We couldn't actually physically get on a plane there for 22 months. And that building never reopened. We just couldn't get a deal with the landlord. We couldn't get there. We couldn't, and that felt like, it didn't just feel like a massive failure. It was actually a massive failure. It was a load of money, a load of time, like horrendous amounts of physical time, dragging my family out there, figuring out how we were going to operate in Los Angeles, building up a community. And it felt like a failure because it was a failure. And I'd never had something like that before, where something completely out of your control. That whole US launch and Los Angeles launch and anchoring there have been super hard anyway. It's a really weird city. We've had loads of issues with the building. We got stuck anyway, really boring stuff in the middle of a landlord dispute. And that was a whole thing about Albright, that it was it's become a very real business, right? You start with the vision, and then you're stuck in the middle of a war about a car park in West Hollywood between two Persian landowners who hate, you know, like madness. And Anna will always say about that, that no one other than me could have resolved it. You know, I was there to go to court and all this stuff. And we'd done it, like every single obstacle. One thing AJ always says about me is that my thing is always who's behind the no. Like if there's a no, I'm like, thanks for the no. Who's behind the no? I didn't hear the no. It's going to be a, and done that in LA. Done it. Got there 2 weeks before. And then that was it.
Wow.
And it felt like a loss, personal loss. And it felt unfair. That's a really complicated feeling in business and in life, because who cares about fair? There's no such thing as fair, right? But it felt like a kernel of a thing that we didn't deserve, that we needed to get over for the sake of the business and reimagine the business. And that's been, you know, the big success of Albright over the last 2 years is the digital platform's now at scale. We've started to build out into Web3. We've done an NFT drop and a metaverse and lots of things that I could, you know, talk about around Albright. But I think the personal journey of it, the personal strength of it, the life-changing aspect of it is Anna and I. Without her, it would have been an absolute miserable shitstorm. And with her, it was manageable. And actually, as I think you will attest, when things are going disastrously wrong like that, there's humor in it, sort of, if you can find it. And she really helped me to do that. Or we do it with each other because we've got very dark senses of humor. So I think it all felt personal. It feels personal. The pandemic felt personal. The team that we've built out, remember, our team is 95% female. So, and that's been so deliberate and a conscious choice to give women opportunities. And then when you're having to lay them off, that doesn't feel great, right? So it's been amazing and awful in equal measure, more than anything that I've ever done. The biggest challenge, the biggest highs, the biggest lows continues to be like that. But the pandemic was another level of discomfort that felt like even I couldn't do who's behind the no. There was just like, none of us could, right? It just was what it was.
Wow. So you've got this cavalcade of bullshit and landing on you all around you. And I'm just interested in unpacking that a little bit. So you've had this, like, it's almost like the, like you say, it's this unfair thing. It's like you're doing the good, you're fighting the good fight. You're out there making or trying to make change. It's happening. There's investment. You're getting behind the no. You're fixing these things. And I'm just curious to sort of again, just to sit in that moment and sort of think, how did you, you know, what was this, the sort of thing that, as it all became apparent that this was going wrong, what was the sort of thing in your heart? And was there a specific moment in time where you can look back and you saw the gravity of the situation?
I think it all happened to us quite quickly, didn't it? I mean, it kind of went from International Women's Day, which is a bit like Christmas for us, March the 8th, 2020. We did our Albright Amazing Women Awards across it here, London, sorry, LA. We did it in Hong Kong. We did it in Sydney. So we bought a business there. They all turned out to be massive super spreader for COVID events, as it turned out, because a girlfriend of ours, Laura Whitmore, had DJed at Cheltenham Racecourse. If you can remember back to all of that time.
She
sort of wiped out the whole of the building. We were there, and I remember, and I actually remember this yesterday because it was the Women's Prize for Fiction Awards last night, and I'm on the board. And one of my really old girl from university is a journalist called Kathy Newman, who does Channel 4 News. And she's also this sort of ridiculous Renaissance woman because she's a cello player. She's in a quartet of journalists and politicians, and they play at the Women's Prize. And I sat next to her on March the 8th, 2020, and she said to me, a black dog is coming, you know, black swan, is coming. And I said, oh, Kathy, don't you know, it's the cold, isn't it? And, you know, she's always quite light. I'm always, and she's always, and we were laughing about it yesterday because she, of course, was right. But she was the first person to really say that. And then a month later, we all knew it. So I think, I'm glad not to have known it earlier, really, because I think that we all dealt with it in the best way that we could at the time. And I think the Albright business, in terms of its breadth, in terms of the digital platform, the metaverse, commercial partnerships, its reach is better than it was before the pandemic. Our revenue is back to pre-pandemic levels. But it was a very personally difficult thing for all of us to go through. But in particular, the physical space component of the Albright business was something that gave it a dynamic that was impossible to manage. And look, I mean, God, we certainly weren't unique in that. And there are plenty of restaurateurs and hospitality industry, you know, like very well documented. But in my own case, it was frustration of not being able to get on a plane and the impact you knew you were having on a team that you built with purpose that was really hard.
So how did you cope with that? I mean, so this is all happening and the frustrations and the sort of all this stuff going on. So you in that moment, and I'm interested in the relationship with your founder, but your co-founder, but so how are you handling that?
Well, I'm quite disciplined. And I think that's a really important part of the way that I cope with anything. I get up early. I exercise every day. During the pandemic, I can see it in the corner of the room. I've got a little gym in the house with a boxing bag. I have to punch the bag every day. I don't do it through yoga. Mindfulness, I do it through sort of violence and sweating. And I think I just try to stick to my routine as much as I could. We had a strange dynamic in our house anyway, because my husband's a surgeon. So he was having, of course, an unbelievably challenging time because he was in the ICU every day and he was dripping off on the doorstep out of his PPE. And, you know, like it was very real in our house. And there's a lot that we need to remember. And I think perspective's a great thing. And so even though there was all of that shit, you know, there was some context, right? And I think that's always important. And trying to give back and do something good and take yourself out. It's the sort of Tuesdays with Maury thing, right? I think that that was important during that time, whatever that meant for you. And as soon as we could get out and walk, we got out, you know, pounded 30,000 steps a day. And as soon as I could meet up with AJ, we looped every single part in London and kind of figuring it all out. But I found that time for an active person and someone whose philosophy is you have to be in the world. You've got to be in the room, actually, you know, who I suppose I trade, particularly now at nearing 50 off my network, which has been built up over a long period of time, for being someone who's credible and who does what they say they're going to do and who's a good person and who supports other people. And when your network feels small and when you can't build it, because I think during the pandemic, Zoom and Teams were fine for existing relationships, but you couldn't build new relationships in that way, really, because you just couldn't get the chemistry going with someone. I think I found it really hard to lead, because if you're used to leading through force of personality and you're not able to touch and feel your human connection with others, I found it a really difficult thing to adjust to. you know, it's not my style to be, I like to be there. I don't like to be through a screen. And I found that really hard.
And so what did you do to kind of sort of deal with that? Were you getting frustrated with yourself or with the situation? How do you, what sort of practical things you kind of found yourself being able to navigate through that?
I think Anna and I always have each other to rant to. And I think that the one of the things we talk about a lot in the book, and what's the thing that's written in neon in the entrance to our building, is that sisterhood works. And it's not that the men and male champions in my life are not important, but I think I've got a very strong group of successful female entrepreneurs who have, you know, ridden the rocky path over the years. And that is a Chatham House WhatsApp group. So, you know, that was very helpful because everybody was going through some version of shit. And I do find as a woman, we're totally in the minority. The light shines on us more strongly in terms of press attention and actually expectation and potential excitement that we might fail. And I found it easier to have my game face off with my close group of fellow female entrepreneurs and travelers. And I think that was a really important resource during that time.
That's really interesting. It's funny, something I've seen the value of in the last 2 years, actually, is a kind of groups of confidants who you can have that type of candor with. And again, how do you build that? How do you build that little group? If someone's listening to this and wants to kind of make that happen?
So organic. And also, my stuff is really specific, because I think it also sits hand in hand with having raised capital. We're dealing with an investor dynamic, which is not always straightforward, with being high profile with. And so there are other women in that category, and you would know them by name because they're well known. But it's a close group. It's a tight knit group, and you don't sort of, it doesn't just happen, I suppose. I think it's also probably a testament in a negative way to how undiverse that group of well-known female founders is, whether it's Martha Lane Fox or Tamara Lohanna, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I was at university with a lot of these people, so I've known them for, you know, 30 years. But someone like Alex DePledge, who is from Bradford, you sense the theme here, who is the founder of
Yorkshire.
The founder of Hassle.com. I'm so un-Yorkshire that anyone would laugh to hear me say that. You can tell me that. He's very professional in Yorkshire. The founder of Hassle.com and founder with Jules Coleman of Resi.co. You know, that's a really important relationship. And we go quite, you know, detail. That's like, you know, I've had this term sheet and it looks like this. And I think there's an issue around the preference and how. And there's not that many people that you can do that with, because it's a specific thing when you're operating at a certain level in a certain way. And also it's very arcane. And I think even for Anna, my co-founder, who's extremely experienced corporately, the world of venture capital and private equity backed startups and scale up is like a weird cult. That if you don't know it, you don't know it, you don't know the language, you don't know the pitfalls, you don't know that. So you do. It's very hard to explain to anyone else. And I think that you treasure those relationships very deeply.
Yeah, interesting. We've got this kind of, you're coming out of this now, I guess, or we're all kind of edging our way into the reality. I have always been in the room, and I found it really, really difficult and disorienting lockdown. You know, from spending my entire career out, I was now in. And I'm actually trying to sort of, I think I've been sort of reconditioned into being too in, and I'm trying to consciously go out more. Yeah. I'm struggling with a little bit. So looking back at that 2 year period or thereabouts, what are the big lessons that you can take out? You've had the whole apple cart upturned from this, yeah, this career on a high, and then suddenly you hit this brick wall and it's like nothing you've ever experienced, and you can't negotiate with the global pandemic. There's nobody behind the no. So what have you learned from that this is sort of 2 year sort of washing machine of experience?
I think it's the same but different, right? Which is, if you get up early, don't chase the day, hit the punch bag, both physically and metaphorically, and work down the list and focus on back to business number one. Where are the economics, right? What's the relationship between CAC and LTV? Like, I'm nerdy. So, like, where is the money? Where's the, and Anna and I are both good at doing that. And understand the data, understand your audience and follow the money and be prepared. Pivot is, I sort of hate the word now because it sounds a bit naff, doesn't it? But be prepared to rip up the old plan. And this, I think, is something that's extremely hard for new entrepreneurs and for so many of the people that we've employed over the years who say, I want to work in a startup or I want to work with you two. You know, that can happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're lying. Do you really?
yes, of course. You know, we would join the whirlwind.
I would, but because what I think you need to be able to do is to say, I know we were doing this thing and I know we invested time, money, output and economics in this thing, but we're ripping up that thing. Actually, this is the thing. And so you need to follow us over here. And I think AJ and I are different, but the things that we have in common, as well as shared values, sense of humor, work ethic, are very short, short-term memories. And I think that often is a tremendous benefit to us because we can't remember, like we had to do it the other day for something where we had to list some award or something, you know, things we'd achieved over the last 2 years. And we've forgotten half of them because the downside of being like that is you don't celebrate your successes. But the upside is that you're not emotionally attached to decisions. And I think we're both really good at saying, that didn't work. Or actually, it's semi-work, but this is going to work better, so we're doing this now. And I think that really is the life lesson of the last 2 years, which is somewhere in between life gives you lemons, but also I think the better one, which is never let a good crisis go to waste, which I think is Churchill. In there somewhere will be the economics. And you just have to look for the economics.
And when you say the economics, what do you mean by that?
The thing that's going to make you money. It's going to make you money. And it might not be the thing you thought was going to make you money. I thought I was meant to have 5 buildings, right? By the end of 2020. I had 3. I signed a lease on a building in New York, which we never even put shovel to ground in. And thank God we hadn't signed a lease in Canary Wharf, which is now a disaster zone. So I thought I was doing that and I'm not doing that now. And that's okay with me. But you have to quickly make that okay with you and follow the economics. And the economics were not there then.
Interesting. So, wow. So this whole experience, so you're coming out of this with a whole new plan, a whole new set of economics, a whole new set of activity, this kind of perhaps renewed focus on the digital aspect of you mentioned about some of the work you're involved in there. And one thing before you sort of, I'm your relationship with your co-founder, you said you have this sort of dark humor thing going on. Can it be any examples of where you've kind of chivied each other along in moments of crisis?
Some of the shit, you just have no idea. It's very real, our business, right? We didn't have that experience. We're not hospitality people. You know, we always say that we've accidentally ended up in the hospitality industry, and that has loads of very real life challenges around buildings and people. And, you know, you're doing high low, right? You're doing these massive high level executions because we invested a fund and we do pitch days with Goldman Sachs, and they're very, and we're serving tea and coffee and, you know, like it's, and everything in between. I think my dynamic with her, I think everyone's intrigued because we're strong women. I think everyone would secretly like to think that we hate each other. And we really don't. Like, we really live in it. You know, when we work, travel, we share a room. And sometimes if they've got the kind of booking wrong, we share a bed. You know, she's just a great woman. But I'm from my background is strong, amazing women that I love, you know, and I've got a lot of strong, amazing women in my life, and she's one of them. But our chemistry, our difference along with our similarity, she's really good at a load of things that I'm not, and vice versa, but we've got some shared superpowers, makes it all the more fun. And in my other businesses, having been a sole founder, particularly Love Home Swap, where I was on my own, it's much more fun doing it with someone else, much more fun. And the dark times are less dark when you're sharing it with someone.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on the sort of dark humor thing. You may have, well, the name of this podcast was I'm ripping myself and blowing my business up. Is kind of that for me? It's like, you know, how you tippy toe through it when it's rough. You know, I have a business partner, and we are intuitively can look at each other in the eye and go, yeah, well, we cocked that up, didn't we? And laugh and crack on. And I think that's kind of like a good spirit to have. I'm going to ask you one last question as we're edging towards the end of our podcast time together. I like to ask this because there's lots of advice for entrepreneurs of all stripes out there. But what advice should entrepreneurs ignore?
I think that... over the years, I've had different versions of can you be a bit less yourself? In other words, I've always been a lone female founder asking men for money. The businesses that I've raised capital for target a female audience, and I'm look like a woman, dressed, I love clothes, dressed like a woman, and I'm very direct. And I think all of those things, and I hope it's changing, have been an uncomfortable package often for men. And if I look at some of the extremely successful female founders I'm lucky enough to call friends, Tanya Bowler, who I've known since we were students, again, who's the founder of LV, who's created this amazing women's health tech business on its way to being a unicorn, started life doing pelvic floor devices and now has a silent breast pump and much more innovation around women's health. She, as many of us have spent a lot of time asking men for money, and we're good at it. But we can still do that and be women. And I think if I were to sum up the advice, that's the wrong advice. It's to be more male or to not be female in your style. And I think that we all have to be who we are. We have to be the best versions of ourselves. And we have to learn, and it's all, you know, lifelong learning and all of that, and be great partners in crime when we have co-founders. But don't let anyone tell you not to be you. That's terrible advice.
I concur. I think it's keeping it real and just actually being yourself is quite liberating in and of itself. And who wants to pretend, you know, it's life's too short. You know, so that's great advice. Well, that's really fantastic sort of whistle-stop tour over your incredible pandemic meltdown but turnaround experience. Where can people find out more about you or get more engaged with what you're up to?
Yeah, so they can go to Albright Collective and find everything that Albright has to offer. If they go onto the App Store and download the app, we also just launched this week our mentor matching service digitally. So it can match people who want a mentor, women looking for mentors or wanting to mentor people. We're also in the metaverse. So you can buy one of our NFTs, which are called the Albright Sisters. They're available on OpenSea. Or you can come into our building in Mayfair and experience everything that there is to see there. And you can find me, I'm Debbie Wasco. I spend a lot more time on LinkedIn than I do on other social platforms, and I post on there every day. And finally, Anna and I wrote a book called Believe, Build, Become, which is a woman's guide to supercharging her career. And it's a very practical guide to a lot of the things that we've discussed, from how to negotiate, how to have an entrepreneurial mindset, to how to build your sisterhood. And without just wishing to flog the book, I would really recommend it. We thought really carefully about how a book could be most useful to women in their careers, and that's the book that we wrote, so do check that out.
Well, I think that's excellent advice, and people should do that. And by the way, your LinkedIn feed is great, and I do read it regularly, and it's really fantastic and pointed and and really, Carl, I admire your kind of drive behind your mission. And by the way, I wanted to thank you because I have three teenage daughters, so I feel very much that the work you're doing is helping forge the future for them. And so genuinely, really well done, and it's really good stuff, and I'm fully behind it. So check her out on LinkedIn and other platforms and buy that book and gift it to your daughters. Perhaps that's what I should be doing for my 18-year-old as she graduates this summer. But listen, fantastic to see you. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Check her out, everybody, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box, just enter it in, and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.